Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening. To those here and those on Zoom, thank you for everyone for being with us this evening. It's good to see all of you. It's nice to be back at Canando for a Dharma talk. It's wonderful. I'd like to thank Roshi Kato Loske and Di Marsulo, who I think was the initiator of the invitation. I'm not sure. Came from the board. I will thank you, board. So, thank you all, Diane, Dan, everybody, and for all of you for being here this evening. Thank you for being here. It's nice to be back at Canando. My name is Ninzan Kyosho Valerie Beer. The Ninzan Kyosho means patient mountain, harmonious spirit. Some days are better than others in that. I haven't quite figured out the harmonious spirit part. The patient mountain, as somebody once said, I have infinite patience for a finite period of time. Let's see, so I've been practicing Zen for almost 35 years. I spent a dozen of that in residence at San Francisco Zen Center, Green Gulch, Tassajara City Center, innumerable practice periods. The last thing I did was I was the Eno at City Center. If all of this terminology is foreign to you, just find one of us in a robe afterward. We'll be happy to decode all of this. But speaking of decoding all of this, this Saturday, a member of Canando, William Thomas, is going to be ordained as a Buddhist priest. And it is the tradition in our branch of Buddhism that the Dharma talk before a major ceremony is about that ceremony. Because these ceremonies can hit all your buttons for religion and church and esoterica and all of that, and they can be pretty off-putting. So my job here tonight is to make this Saturday ordination welcoming and not off-putting. It's not separating. It's an invitation to come together. But you might be wondering, so what is a Buddhist priest anyway? And my guess is that right about now, William is probably wondering that also. What am I getting myself into? A lot of fabric, as it turns out. A lot of fabric, as Lee and Umar and others of you who are in fabric in here. So the first thing William is going to do is he's actually going to get dressed. He's going to come in the underrobes, and he's going to pile on all of this fabric. And then he's going to take some impossible vows. And it's going to look like he's changing, but actually he's not. Agent Roshi, Linda Ruth Cutts, who some of you know, the former abbess of San Francisco Zen Center, like to say before every single ordination, she said, a ceremony is for what you already are. It's just an acknowledgement, a celebration, a confirmation of what you already are. So William has already agreed to live in this manner. So in a way, nothing changes. So let me address the big question of what does it mean to be a Buddhist priest? The ceremony of becoming a Buddhist priest is called Shukkei Tokudo, which means leaving home and attaining the way. And that used to mean moving into a monastery. And some of us in this millennium actually did that. Can you believe that? There's still people who like chuck their Silicon Valley corporate careers and move into a monastery. Yeah. Some of us are crazy enough to do that. But today, and perhaps hundreds of years ago, what it really meant to leave home, shukkei tokudo, to leave home and attain the way, was to leave behind all of our certainties and all of our stories and our fortress of competence that we have built in our jobs and our relationships, and to walk out that door. There will be a time for all of us when we don't come home. The day will come when we will leave home for the last time and we won't come home. So we might as well start practicing now. And this is what a priest vows to do, is to leave home and attain the way. And home in this case nowadays is not necessarily a building with an address. It's all those things I just mentioned. It's being willing to drop our stories, drop our expectations, drop, drop, drop. And to be open and vulnerable and receptive to what shows up. This doesn't mean to be run over by everything and to say yes to everything. It doesn't mean that. But it means to cultivate what in Buddhism is called right view. Which doesn't mean I'm right and you're wrong, or I'm right and you're left. It doesn't mean all of that. It means right as in upright, like a ship. A well-constructed ship comes back to being upright regardless of the waves that are knocking it around. So the job of a priest is to drop as much as possible so that a 360-degree view becomes possible. Because in the ceremony, William will not only take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, he will agree to become a refuge. And this is the second thing that a priest is. They leave home in order to become a refuge, to become a safe space, to become a Kalyanamitra, a good friend on the path, to wake up with, because waking up is really scary and can be frightening when all that stuff drops away. And in terms of the job of what a priest does, a priest is a steward of the temple forms and ceremonies. There's a name for this, it's called the doshi. It's when they stand at the mat like I just did for this last service and hold the space. And hold it with a mind of invitation, not of a mind of correction and criticism. But to invite everybody to say, you too can do this. This is the priest's mantra, you too can do this. And to be welcoming and inviting. To know the ceremonies, not just the words and the choreography that you see the doshi do when they're up here, but to know the meaning of the ceremony, to be able to explain it, to be able to cut through that religious high church stuff that is so off-putting about temples of any stripe, and to be able to say, come in. Not only can you too be part of this practice and realize enlightenment, but you already are. part of this practice. You already are enlightened. So this leaving behind, this I don't know, is very important. This dropping away of preferences. Sojourn Mel Weitzman, the late abbot of Berkeley Zen Center, wrote this about his own ordination in 1969. The occasion of a priest ordination always brings up questions about what it means to be ordained. We can look at this by examining what ordination has meant in Zen tradition, and also by considering our practice in the present day. When I was about to be ordained in 1969, I asked Suzuki Roshi what it meant to be ordained as a priest and what I should do. And he said, I don't know. Then I asked Katagiri Sensei, and he said, I don't know. So to take up this practice with a robe or not is to take a deep breath and to say, I don't know. And there is great freedom in that, to be able to say, I don't know. I grew up in a household where you never said that. You never said, I don't know. You had better have the answer and it better be straight A's. And then somewhere along 3 or 4 years into my practice, I got really tired of that and decided that don't know mine might have had some benefits. And now I love saying, I don't know. It's like I walked in tonight and I said to Diana, I don't know how to do this. How do you get into the Zendo around here? What do you do during service? It's like, okay. And I bet none of you could tell I didn't know what I was doing, or maybe you did and you giggled inside and it didn't matter. To leave home and attain the way. I mentioned that the first thing William is going to do is get into all this fabric. It's going to be black. Black is the color for priests in training. And it is this big robe. There are some people around, Camille and Tim and others, who are in a smaller robe that came along later, but it's the same pattern. So here's the story briefly. As the story goes, King Bimbisara, a contemporary of the historical Buddha and a disciple of the Buddha, was riding along on his, what? Probably an elephant at this point, probably not a horse, I would guess, and saw what he thought was a fellow disciple of the Buddha and got down off his mount to be able to bow to this monk and got up close and realized that it was not a disciple of the Buddha, it was one of the other various spiritual traditions that was running around. So King Bimbisara went to the Buddha and said, basically, would you please get yourself, your folks in some distinctive clothing so I know who my brothers and sisters are in this practice? And the Buddha agreed. Sometime after that, the Buddha and his attendant and cousin, Ananda, were walking along and they saw a rice field. You may go home and do a search on rice fields. And if you do that, you will pull up the exact pattern of rice fields that they were 2,500 years ago, because that's the way rice is best grown. If it's not broke, don't fix it. So this is still how rice is grown. And this is a rice field pattern that you can see probably better on the smaller robes that are around. So those of you that have a smaller robe, if you'd kind of just pause for a moment. Maybe somebody there on Zoom who has one. There you go, Elizabeth, hold that up to the camera so folks can see this. This is, it looks just like a rice field that you will see today. And here we are. The first robe was the big one, the kesa, kashaya in Sanskrit, which means muddy cloth. It was made from found cloth, the dirtier the better. And it was picked up and dyed and cut and made into a robe. And we still do that. We have people here today sewing for ordination, for taking the precepts. And you're likely to see at least 3 colors of robes around Kanando, perhaps 4. The blue rakusu is for zaikei tokudo, staying home, and attaining the white. The black robe is for Shukke Tokudo, leaving home and taking the and attaining the white. The brown robe is for Dharma transmitted lineage holders who have permission to teach. So for teacher of someone who is a priest and became a lineage holder and a teacher. And there are green rakusus. A green rakusu is for a lay entrusted teacher. This is wonderful. There's one. Yes, thank you. For a lay entrusted teacher, this is someone who has chosen to not take the temple maintenance path, if you will, that the priest takes, and is recognized as a teacher with something to say about the Dharma that others want to listen to. So this is, as far as I know, this is a Western invention to acknowledge long-time lay practitioners who are recognized as good teachers of the Dharma, who have something that speaks to others' hearts and can convey that. So we have both the temple path and the lay path going on here, which is quite wonderful, which means basically everybody. Everybody is included. The Buddha said all beings without exception have Buddha nature, are Buddha nature, and are capable of waking up in every moment. So William's going to get dressed. And that's just the beginning. And then he's going to take some vows to not take life, to not take what is not given, to not misuse sexuality, to not lie, to not indulge in intoxicants, to not speak ill of others, to not praise self at the expense of others, to not be stingy, to not indulge in anger and ill will, and to not disparage the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And these are impossible vows. These are impossible and worth doing. And worth doing. The point is not to accomplish the vows. The point is to move the needle. Move the needle in the direction of the reduction of suffering. If you want Buddhism in one sentence, here's the elevator pitch on Buddhism. Buddhism believes that we all have the capacity to reduce suffering. That's it. That's all it is. All the rest is commentary. This is all about reducing suffering. So William is going to take some vows again that he already took, same ones, to redouble his efforts on the reduction of suffering. I sewed a blue rakusu in 1995 and took my first set of vows in 1997. I lived at San Francisco Zen Center from 2003 to 2014, and during that time, I was ordained at Green Gulch Farm in late 2005, or in early 2005. And when my teacher shaved my head, I felt like I finally became what I came to this life to be. In the almost 20 years since my own Shukke Tokudo, since my own ordination and leaving home, there have been difficulties and joys of being a priest. But always there were all of you, the Sangha, the Kalyanamitra, the good friends on the path that hold us up so we can fall apart. Because that's what enlightenment requires, is falling apart and the willingness to do so. so that we can be put back together by the Dharma and each other, and all for the reduction of suffering. And it has had its hard moments. So, William, I don't know if you're here tonight or stuck on a bridge somewhere in traffic, but just to let you know what you're getting into, here were my have been my hardest moments so far in the last 20 years. Being the doshi for the funeral for my mom and dad. Not getting to be the doshi for the funeral of one of my students who died a month into the lockdown, and I couldn't go. Being the doshi at the last minute for a service that I have no idea what's going to happen, and trusting the Doan to do the right thing. Being told by men that they don't approve of my short hair or no hair, and that women can't be real priests. Sitting in practice discussion with a student who has just made a credible threat of suicide. Being a target for others' projections about authority figures, parents, bosses, priests, religion in general, you name it. Being treated abusively by practitioners who actively and frantically resist turning the light inward and blamed me for making them look there. And having to let go and bow out of some relationships when I realize that I don't have the skills to meet the other person without breaking several precepts. I have a lifelong habit of staying too long in abusive relationships, and wearing this robe has been a real challenge to learn to bow out without slamming the door and without hating myself, because I couldn't do it, because I couldn't be relating to everybody. And the best part has been that even in those moments, I feel like I am what I came to this life to be. And when I stand at the end of that bowing mat for service, I can feel all the ancestors around me cheering me on, supporting me and everybody else in this sendo to wake up and to remember that we already are. And right there is the joy in every moment of wearing all of this cloth. So thank you, William, wherever you are, for leaving home and taking this leap into the unknown on Saturday. And thank you to the Sangha, to all of you, for supporting William to do this, and for trusting that all of you together will figure out what it means to be a priest at Canada. Do we take questions and chant, or chant and take questions?
No, we do questions.
Questions first, okay. So thank you to the people on Zoom. Thank you to the people in the room. I'd be happy to entertain questions, comments, complaints, arguments.
Hi, Julian.
Hi, Julian.
If people have questions in the room, please speak up so everyone can hear.
My question is, based on your experience or in insights. Under what circumstances should a person absolutely not or probably not seek to put on robes?
Julian's question is about knowing oneself well enough to know that you may not be ready to do this. I think that's pretty wise, don't you, to know? You've got some mirrors around you. And, you know, if you watched me up in the mat and said, yikes, I could never do that, you're probably not ready. If you watched that and went, oh, that's pretty sweet. Maybe someday I could do that. I mean, this is one of the things that Sangha is for, is to let us know. You know, in the Buddha's time, the most important thing that you could give in Dana Paramita, which is the generosity, the Paramita of generosity, the most important thing you could give wasn't money or material goods, it was courage. Courage was the most important thing. And so we give each other courage. And one of the courage that we give to each other is not necessarily to put a robe on, but to realize that you can't right now. That's the courage. Okay? All right. Thank you. Let's see if there's any questions online. Maybe Gosho, if you do. Otherwise, I'll go to someone else in the room. Uma.
You've used this word impossible. Right? My brain keeps on breaking it into two. It says, I'm possible. It keeps on doing that. Every time you said impossible, I kept on hearing, I'm possible. So it's like, I don't know what's going on there, but it's just that sort of the idea to keep going.
Yeah, thank you. So if you weren't able to hear Umar, he said that he's parsing impossible as I'm possible. I like that. That's a lovely vowel. That's a lovely one. Thank you. Dave, I think. Yes?
Yes. Thank you so much for your talk, Valerie. I find my head still spinning about your story about somebody basically attacking you for shaving your head and being a priest or a female. Should I not be amazed by that?
I remember at the moment that happened, I was in the Green Gulch Sendo, and I was stepping up to be the Doshi to service, and the man said, women can't be priests. And then after service, he found me out in Cloud Hall and he said, I don't approve of women not having any hair. And I just bowed to him. I mean, what to do with that? I feel great compassion for those who don't have that, who maybe aren't willing or ready in their lives. Back to your question about being ready, right? Back to Julian's question about being ready to widen the inclusivity net a little bit. And my heart goes out to him. And this was, you know, maybe 15 years ago. And I hope my wish for him would be broad view, because he's clearly suffering. So thank you, Dave.
What a marvelous answer. Thank you so much.
I want to ask you a question. You worked for Steve Jobs for a little while, correct?
I did.
How was that relationship?
So the question was that I worked for Steve Jobs. Yes, I did work for Steve Jobs. The book is right. The movie is, forget it, not. So read the book. Don't watch the Ashton Kutcher movie. This is not my way-seeking mind talk. I gave that a couple years ago. But basically, yes, I did. I had a decade and a half career in high tech in Silicon Valley, Apple, Netscape. And I did work for Steve Jobs. Not while I was at Apple. I left Apple and went to Netscape and then went somewhere else. That's a whole different story. But what I finally realized was that I was not able to be what I needed and wanted in that environment. So, and this actually has nothing to do with Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs was actually, just to answer Umar's question about what it was like to work for him, it was insanely wonderful because he was a madman and he had brilliant ideas for how to bring computing to everybody. And, you know, I would follow him off a cliff. I would. He was amazing. He really was. It was an insane honor to work for him. Anyway, I mentioned that when my teacher shaved my head when I was ordained, I felt like I finally became what I came to this life to be. And some of you are going to maybe thinking of the next question that you want to ask is, so how do you bring this practice into your work environment, into your corporate environment? I am the wrong person to ask because I don't know. I couldn't do it. So I chucked my corporate career and moved into a monastery. And Les can tell you all kinds of stories about that. So, yes. Sherry, good evening. Nice to see you from Humboldt.
Good to see you too. Thank you for what you've shared. I'm wondering, from your point of view, to what degree is confidence an aspect of readiness?
Well, this isn't the answer you want to hear, but I'm going to say it anyway. It's the confidence of I don't know. It's being okay with that. It's the confidence of I don't know.
So many thanks.
Oh, I forgot to add, that's really scary. I don't know. Part of the issue is that by measuring ourselves by how much we get done and the length of our to-do lists, we don't have space for that. I don't know. In fact, we deliberately try to keep it at bay by being busy, which flies in the face of one of the really hard Buddhist words in English, emptiness. This is not a talk on emptiness, but basically, let's just say it's the arising and fading away of all things. Let's just go with that for just a minute, okay? So all things, all conditioned things, the Buddha said, arise and fade away, except we don't let them. We freeze them, we cling them, we hang on to them, we check them off. We want the surety and the certainty, and the universe isn't like that. And so this confidence that this is going on, and we are not observers of this, okay? Let me say this really loud and clear. We are not observers of emptiness. We are participants in emptiness, whether we like it or not. So as a friend of mine likes to say, we might as well ride the horse in the direction it's going, okay? And the more we can say and have confidence in the I don't know, the more field of vision we have to be able to see that this is going on and participate in it. And boy, am I going to date myself right now. There was a jump rope game when way before electronic devices, when I was growing up, that we used to play. And you had to time that jump in. So the rope was going like this. Some of you know this game. The rope is going around, two of your friends are holding the rope, and you have to jump in and not get caught on the rope. And that's what we need to do with emptiness, is to watch this arising and fading away and jump in. And that requires mostly, I don't know. But I'm willing to look. I'm guessing somebody who knows the Canon Doe schedule will tell me when it's time to do the closing chant. we have Elizabeth? Yes. And then this gentleman here. Elizabeth, go ahead.
I can't help but wonder when you began learning skillful means and if you knew about that when you were in high tech at Apple and were finding yourself in challenging situations in that environment.
At that point, actually, I'm not sure it was skillful means yet. What it was an increasingly comfortable mismatch between how I had to be in that environment and what my heart really wanted to be. Jack Kornfield's definition of enlightenment is my favorite. He defines enlightenment as an undefended heart. An undefended heart. Jack Kornfield's definition of enlightenment. Okay. Yes, sir, please.
Just to clarify, so when you reach the stage of I don't know, should be followed, but I'm willing to.
Yeah, I'm willing to find out. I'm willing to find out. So there's in the traditional Buddhist way, there are seven factors of enlightenment. It's kind of like the seven dwarfs. I can always remember six, right? But the first two are most important: attention and investigation. And if we're willing to do that, if we're willing to turn our attention and investigate rather than check off, that's the precursor. You know, that's the what follows on from I don't know. I don't know is the translation of that is I'm willing to investigate, right? And then some attention and then investigation, energy, joy is number four. Mm-hmm. And the last three, we'll have to look up. But the first ones are critical. Attention and investigation is being willing to be an I don't know, but I'm going to see if I can find out. Yes.
Hi, thank you. I really enjoyed your talk. I was wondering how you let go of needing to know and how you can surrender to an I don't know state, because that just seems like such a game of tug of war. And is it just a process where it's non-linear, where it's some days are easier than others, or is it just like a switch?
All of that. All of that. So I got straight A's most of my life in school. I was the valedictorian of my high school class. I got straight A's in college. And then I began to fail my marriage. I failed as a parent, although I fortunately recovered. My daughter is happy and 40. And I realized that knowing is a burden. Intellectual knowing is a very heavy burden. But it took me quite a while. And actually what it took me was it took me a Tassajara practice period where I literally didn't know anything and had to spend 90 days not knowing and stumbling to really break myself out of this. And it's still hard. I can still feel that clench in my chest when I have to say, I don't know. But it's a quicker, more joyful, I don't know now, because I'm going to find out. There's this story about the Buddha and King Shaka that is germane to your question. King Shaka and the Buddha are having tea, apparently. King Shaka, the king of the gods. And King Shaka said, yeah, so what do these bodhisattvas do anyway? It looks to me like they just sit a lot. What do they do anyway? And the Buddha said, they wisely await ripening. They wisely await ripening. This is the being willing to hang out in I don't know, Because a lot of times when we don't know, we think it's all about us, but actually we forget that there's an answer out there that may not be ready yet either. And so we wait for the arising of the answer. And I would guess that everybody in this room and everybody on this screen knows what happens when we push for the solution and the answer prematurely. It's never good. It's never good. So to wisely await ripening is a corollary of learning to love, I don't know, because the answer isn't ready yet.
Thank you.
We don't know the next moment. We will never know the next moment. But we know the current moment. So in some way we do know. But we don't know and know at the same time.
Yeah.
That's empty.
Yeah, except that we do get attached to the outcome, and we get attached to the outcome very fast. And that is something to investigate, is how quickly we want that answer, that certainty. We do get attached to an outcome, and this is worth investigating. Expectations in Buddhism are considered one of the most pernicious forms of greed. Expectations are a form of greed because we get clamped on an outcome. And then what happens when that doesn't come true? We get mad at the person who screwed up and didn't make our expectation come through, right? Oh, did we even tell them we had a specific outcome? Probably not. So we expected them to be a mind reader. And the problem is right here with the expectation about the outcome. So this is a very insidious form of greed, is to be careful about the depth of I don't know needing to extend to what we think this is going to look like and how we think it's going to go. So it is a worthwhile endeavor to let go of the outcome. And all I would say is just try to move the needle on that a little bit. Because inevitably, when we try something, we do have an expectation. We do have an outcome. Yes, good evening. Yeah, the question was, the world that I came from, the corporate world I came from, was all about goals and expectations and, you know, exceeding expectations, right? If you got met expectations on your performance review, ooh, right, that was not good, right? So exceeding expectations, how did that translate? My memory of the start of practice is that I just wanted a refuge. I didn't have a design about becoming a priest, about wearing a robe. I basically turned down the road at Green Gulch Farm and felt like I was coming home. And it's felt like that ever since. It has. So somewhere in there, I was able to drop my head into my heart. And I didn't have expectations of practice. It felt more and more like becoming what I came here to be, more and more aligned with this. I didn't have a goal of becoming a priest. I had a goal of becoming quiet and kind. And in case you're wondering, yes, of course, I do have a goal, if you want to put it that way, a vow, I would be the way I would say it for my practice. It isn't what I want to get done, it's how I want to be, regardless of what I'm doing. So my vow for this life is to be kind and helpful, regardless of what I'm being. You can call it a goal if you want, but it's a goal. You see the difference? It's a goal of how to be, rather than a goal of something to get done. And my vow for beyond is to do good in the universe with love. But for right now, it's to be kind and helpful. And it makes a difference. I'm going to tell a really quick story that some of you have heard before, so I'll make it fast and then we can chant. 2 years ago in December, I ended up in the emergency room at Kaiser Redwood City for what was either a heart attack or COVID. It turned out to be neither, but it took them 2 hours to figure that out through all kinds of tests. So I'm sitting there in an isolation unit because in case it was COVID, and everybody's coming in, you know, with triple PPE on and all kinds of stuff, just in case it was COVID. My anxiety was pretty high and so was theirs. And I realized this sort of immediately walking in the door, and I took a vow as I walked in the emergency room and said, I'm gonna be kind. I'm just gonna be kind to whoever walks in the door. Yeah. I can feel all this anxiety and I'm just gonna do my best to be kind. I can't be helpful because I don't know what's going on. They're the people that are gonna help me, but I can be kind. And not only did it really take down my anxiety, I could tell that it took down the pressure on the people who came in to help me. Because I greeted them. I didn't bow to them. I thought that might be a little much. But I greeted them. I asked them if their families had been safe during COVID. And the conversation went from there while they were sticking me and patching me up and doing all kinds of, you know, crazy tests. And when I left, 2 hours later, the ER staff that was not engaged with other patients at the moment came and stood at my isolate. And they said, you're the kindest person we've had in here all day. And I was well. So part of this practice is switching from goals about what to get done and check off, and goals about how to be, regardless of what you're doing. How do we want to be when we end up in the ER, the IRS, the DMV, divorce court, funeral home? How are we going to be? Are we going to add to suffering? Or are we going to at least not make it worse? If we can't reduce it, are we going to at least not make it worse? So that's the shift that Buddhism asks of us, is to shift from a to-do list of checking things off to a vow, or if that's too strong a word for you, for a promise of how I want to be, regardless of what I am doing.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.